A graphic novel, a TV show. Well, it's not TV, it's HBO. And will this thing succeed? And by how much, man? And some might cheer and some might scoff, because it's Damon Lindelof. But either way, we're off to watch some Watchmen. Watching Watchmen, talking Watchmen, analyzing Watchmen, and maybe arguing over Watchmen.
Who watches the Watchmen? We watch Watchmen. You watch Watchmen. We all watch Watchmen. All at the same time, simultaneously, you might say, because all things are happening at the same time. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we are going to be talking about the penultimate episode of the first season, presumably the first season, of Watchmen, a show on HBO.
I like that confidence. I like that confidence there.
I mean, listen, we talked about this a little bit on the bonus podcast, but there's almost no way that they're not going to want to do a second season. Just the question is if it's actually going to happen at this point, I think, right?
Show's too successful. I mean, I agree with you, but I mean, this episode was evidence that they're putting it all on the table. You're going to have to get a little creative for a second season.
Yeah. I mean, they were pretty uncreative this season, so they'll definitely like have to amp up the creativity for the second season.
You, for God's sakes, put an idea out there.
Right? Come on, buddy. We're going to be talking to be about a god walks into a bar. Now, there were some questions about the name of this episode. It was originally put out there as a god walks into a bar, but I think it's pretty clear based on the title in the episode, and I believe also what they submitted to the Writers Guild to register the script was a god walks into a bar is the actual title of the episode. So I want to ask you something, Justin. We'll get into a recap of what's happened previously, as well as walking through the whole episode. Do you think they came up with the name Cal Abar and Angela Abar just for this one joke?
I do. I do think that. It's like a common name, so I think it was specifically made for this. Like, I bet all the wordplay came first, and they backed into having her name be Angela Abar.
That's how you construct a good pun, though. You come up with the punchline, and then you figure out what the setup is. So there you go.
The best puns the best puns exist at all times, and you have to you just experience them your entire life.
Exactly. I did look it up because I wanted to make sure, but Abar is an actual surname. It's most prevalent in Syria, and the highest density is in Djibouti. Which is interesting because Doc Manhattan has a nice Djibouti as well.
Wow, that's a great point. And that pun exists at all places and all times as well.
Right. I actually started with that pun and then worked backwards to the facts. So there you go. All right. Let's give a recap of what's happened so far. There's only three main characters who really need to know about this episode, who are Adrian Veidt, Dr. Manhattan, a.k.a. Cal Abar. Big spoiler there if you haven't been keeping up with the show. And Angela Abar. Let's start with Adrian Veidt. Adrian Veidt is a vigilante, superhero, whatever you want to call him, known as Ozymandias, the smartest man in the world. Back in the 1980s, he pulled off an ingenious plan to stop the world from annihilating itself through the nuclear threat, specifically Russia and the United States. Tensions were building. And the way that he did it is he concocted an incredibly elaborate plan involving an alien squid that he had created. It wasn't an actual alien squid that he dropped in Times Square. The resulting psychic blast killed over 3 million people and sent out a story that interdimensional invaders were invading our dimension. Now, as we found out, he was somewhat successful. There's not a nuclear threat necessarily, but otherwise society has pretty much moved on. It has continued. There are still squid rains every once in a while, but people seem very laissez-faire, lackadaisical about them as they happen.
It's just a little squid rain.
Yeah.
Rain. Sleet is like squid rain for us. It's just like, it's sleeting out.
I'll tell you what, I was walking through some hail the other day. It was very sharp on my face. I would have rather being hit by squids.
Tiny squids, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Tiny squids. Now, we don't know what we find out this episode, but we didn't know what happened to Adrian Veidt between that point and the point in time that we were following on the Watchmen TV show, other than he disappeared. Where he actually went to is Europa, a moon of Jupiter, and there he has been living in a paradise that has turned into a nightmare for him, as multiple clones of beings called Phillips and Crookshanks have seemed to serve him, but he has tried to escape multiple times. He left a message made of their corpses outside on the moon, outside of the habitat, but was captured by a man named Game Warden, who was another clone of Phillips. He was put on trial, didn't say anything in his defense, and was ultimately imprisoned. And that's where we left him. There's other questions about him that we'll probably get to as we talk about the episode, but that's the main thing you need to know. The other two main players in here are Angela Abar and Cal Abar, a.k.a. Dr. Manhattan. Dr. Manhattan, just to mention, is a big blue guy. He is a white guy from the comics. and he, as far as we knew, left for Mars at the end of the book, but sort of threw out a couple of things, specifically, hey, maybe I'll create my own life. That might be an interesting thing to do. He is an all-powerful superhero, or seemingly all-powerful superhero, though as we talked about on our podcast with the comic book, he's not as powerful as people think.
No, he's not a god per se. He has control of atoms, and he can rearrange them to construct things. But he's not not as powerful as he thinks, and he's also not as, like, he's not like, God, I gotta live. God, I gotta find a way to survive here. He's just like, this is whatever. He's very laissez-faire, to use your word, about what he's thinking.
He has self-awareness about his own timeline. He exists in every moment in his own timeline simultaneously, but he's not omniscient. He doesn't know everything about everybody at all times. He only knows what is happening to him, as well as a lot of other stuff that he can figure out based on the fact that he can read atoms and other things like that.
His life is just a movie that he's seen before.
Yes, it's like that song from the Muppet movie. Life's like a movie, keep believing, etc.
Yes, that's exactly what I think the show is referencing. And if you play that song with this episode, it syncs up perfectly.
Oh, shit, that's fucked up, man. Yeah. So the other thing that you probably need to know about Dr. Manhattan, as we found out the last episode, he has been hiding out in the body of a guy named Cal Abar, or we find out a lot more about that this episode and exactly what was going on, but that was the presumption. She hit him on the head with a hammer and pulled a device out and said, hey, baby, we're in fucking trouble, and that's where we end the episode. Now, the she I'm talking about is Angela Abar, who is the wife of Cal Abar. Angela Abar is a cop based in Tulsa. She grew up in Vietnam. She was orphaned at a very young age, grew up in an orphanage, was almost taken out of the orphanage by her grandmother, June, but her grandmother, June, had a heart attack as she was taking her to leave. And so Angela grew up in Vietnam, became a cop in Vietnam. But when we picked up with her on the show, she was living in Tulsa, and Tulsa had experienced an event called the White Night. The White Night is what a group called the 7th Cavalry, which is a bunch of racists that have adopted the vigilante Rorschach's teachings in the most extreme ways possible. They are building a plan to capture Dr. Manhattan, take his powers, and essentially become blue superpowered racists and push forward the white agenda of the world. You're laughing, but that's
just
what
to say, just very casually say, they're going to become blue superpowered racists.
You know,
it's a funny thing that we're casually saying.
Every TV show hits that plot line eventually. I remember when they hit it on Grey's Anatomy, and I was like, come on, guys, this old chestnut.
Yeah, it's a classic Grey's Anatomy plot point.
Yes. So Angela found out a little bit about this plan from Lady True, who doesn't play into this episode, but she is a trillionaire who has followed on the teachings of Adrian Veidt. She ran back to her house, hit Cal with a hammer. That's when she says, hey, baby, we're in fucking trouble. And we glimpsed in the last episode that it didn't seem that Angela noticed a bunch of the 7th Cavalry are right outside of her house. That's pretty much everything you need to know, and everything else I think we'll pick up with as we walk through the episode. So
that's,
let's get into it.
We also should also say Lube Man vanished into the sewer system, and they're going to pick that up in season 2, episode 1.
Absolutely. He's going to slide right in there. The old silver slipper himself.
Yes,
now, as it starts right off from the beginning, they tell you exactly what is going to happen here when the Watchmen logo switches from yellow to blue. This is the Dr. Manhattan episode. This is the flashback episode. One thing I want to ask you up front, which I was curious to get your take on, Justin, Dr. Manhattan is a insanely hard character to write that works very well on the page. Clearly, the way that Alan Moore wrote him and Dave Gibbons draws him, we get a bunch of different Dr. Manhattan things, but there's a main Dr. Manhattan issue where we see how he lives his life simultaneously at all points. And I feel like it makes a lot of sense on the page because you're able to look at several panels at once. You're essentially able to see several realities at the same time. That's not how TV works unless they're doing a split screen, and that's not the choice they make here, but we still get to see Dr. Manhattan jumping through time. Overall, how did the conceit work for you?
I thought it was great. I thought they were smart in the way they shot, especially the beginning of the episode, where it was all like close-up shots. He never got to see Dr. Manhattan and his full body, except for sort of sparingly throughout the episode, and so it played like comic book panels, and then the when you actually get to see them, that's like the larger splash pages, and when you get into more standard looking scenes. So I thought that helped to shake up the way that we're perceiving reality, and just the way they jumped around and how everything sort of rhymed with each other, and we saw the pieces in sort of the way we needed to understand what was happening, despite the fact that it wasn't the actual chronological order. All very smart, and I thought it amounted to such a sweet, like bittersweet end to the episode that I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, this is, I definitely want to take credit for this. There's a great writer over at Vanity Fair named Joanna Robinson, and she sent out a tweet after the last episode, but I know she was talking about this one as well, where she did a still from Lost, a still from The Leftovers, and a still from Watchmen, and the text was, "My favorite romance author is Damon Lindelof." And I think that's absolutely true here. He only co-wrote the episode. This is with Jeff Jensen, who was an EW writer back in the day, who used to write these insanely long, insanely complex and detailed Loss recaps. But this is a romance story the entire time, and an absolutely beautiful one at that.
Yeah. Because the narrative bits are out of order, it may not seem like a natural like way to tell the story, but emotionally it heightens like perfectly to the last couple of moments of the episode that obviously we'll get to. But the emotional heightening is so good, and you get to really see them fall in love even though it's out of order, which is great.
Yeah, very, very cool stuff. Now, I don't know if you want to walk us through it. I mostly took some Easter egg and other notes, Justin.
Oh, great. So why don't you handle the Easter stuff? You handle the little chocolates and the little eggs, and I'll handle the rest of the holidays.
Okay? Basically, you're the host, and I'm the child who comes in and says, "Give me jelly beans."
Yeah, you're like, "I have chocolate now," and this chocolate is a reference to Dave Gibbons' art. But yeah, let's walk into it. Like you said, a god walks into a bar. The fact that there's no space in it in the text as Dr. Manhattan walks through it, I thought that was cool and a little bit of like, in your eye, idiots. It's been right in front of your face the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were very clear about it. And it's funny, it even says on HBO's site, and I'm not sure if they'll change it after the airing, but it has the space between A and bar, but it's not that way in the show at all.
Ballsy.
They're very clear about what it is. The other things probably to mention just right about this first scene as Dr. Manhattan walks into the bar. It's on VVN Day, which is Victory in Vietnam Day, I think we've established. They never specifically say that, but that seems to be, I think that's what you astutely
that
pointed
was, I
out.
Guess,
probably.
Yeah.
And so this is the same day that Angela's parents died, as she notes later on in the episode, because they were also killed on a much earlier VVN day. Also, it's the same place that her grandmother died. Now, this is something that we didn't really touch on, but in the shot of her grandmother dying, as young Angela walks around the car, there's a mural of Dr. Manhattan in the background, and we see the mural of Dr. Manhattan has devil horns painted on it and a devil goatee, and it's generally been defaced because the Vietnamese people have a very complicated relationship with Dr. Manhattan, what with him destroying them and winning the Vietnam War for America. But it's even more defaced here. Like, even the devil horns have been washed away, clouds have been added, more graffiti on it, which I thought was kind of interesting. And clearly Angela is coming back here to the place where her grandmother died to have a drink. But the other interesting thing is they're having a drink in Mr. Eddie's Bar, which I think has to be named after the comedian, right?
I would think. I mean, why not?
Right.
Why would it not be that?
Yeah. The other thing that he does, which is important, that they don't really touch on in the episode, and it's fascinating to me that they don't go back to this point, though I imagine it's because it's well-trod in the comic book, is he grabs two beers in very high glasses. You're a bartender, or were a bartender. What are the name of the high glasses for beer? Is there a specific name? Or
I think they're called beer glasses.
Okay.
I mean, I would call those, you could say Pilsner glasses, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, so he grabs two
Pilsner
glasses.
Tall glass.
Yeah, yeah. And brings them back to her. They are the exact same shape and type of beer that he used to grab with Jenny Slater, which was his first, well, last human girlfriend before he died and was reborn as Dr. Manhattan. And a lot of this is really riffing on that. There was something that Jeff Jensen, again, I believe, posted up before the episode, where he's like, Dr. Manhattan in bars, a history. And there is... there's the bar where Eddie Blake killed the pregnant woman that he impregnated, and Dr. Manhattan was just standing and watching. There's Jenny Slater and him who got drinks on New Year's Eve, I think it was, at a bar, and they get beer like that. So it's the same sort of thing. Like, you've been using the word rhyming a lot, and I think that's absolutely correct. That's essentially what we're doing here. And then he sits down with Angela, but I do have another question for you, which I wasn't 100% sure about. Is that Yahya Abdul-Mateen in the mask, or is that a different actor?
It's hard. I was thinking of that as well. I would think it would be, but I don't know. I guess actually it doesn't make sense in the story for it to be. It would make sense that it was a different person.
There is an actor who I believe in this episode, and definitely in the third episode, was credited as John, as in John Osterman. And I think the third episode, that's because there was the painting. Yeah. So it was probably him in the painting. And then this one, maybe he played that body and they did some dialogue tweaks, because it almost sounds like Yahya Abdul-Mateen's voice, but a little lighter and fuller and a little higher than his regular voice.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's interesting. There, I'm not 100% sure what choice they went for.
If I had to put money on it, I'd say it's not, just because they're so meticulous with those story points. But in another show, I would think it would be him. And it's just like, because that makes sense in another, just as from a casting point of view and a production point of view. Like, have him, he is the character, so you would have him do it, and we'll just shoot around him so you don't ever see his face, because you're not, he probably doesn't have the cow face at that point.
Right. Those were most of my notes for that point. Do you want to keep talking through it?
Well, just something to talk about. I mean, talking about the way Dr. Manhattan is presented, like, he's sort of like a jerk, especially when it comes to his partners, as you say, his last human girlfriend. He's not super nice to her, and you should always be nice to your last human girlfriend, the old adage. And he's sort of careless as he's sort of losing his humanity. He doesn't care for people's feelings. And so when he walks into the bar and he's clearly glommed onto Angela, and he's like, we're going to date. And you sort of think, like, why? Is he just continuing this thing of like, oh, it's just something he's doing arbitrarily, or he sees a young woman, he's like, I want that right now. Like he did with Lori. And so the fact that the story starts there and builds into this great sort of retroactive love story, I thought was great. And they do a great job of making us feel dubious of him. We're with Angela this whole time. Mm-hmm. This like very strange stranger walks up to her in the bar and she's like humoring him. She's sad. She's alone. On this day of all days. And she's like, yeah, I'll tolerate this guy. He's at least interesting, despite the fact that he's all blue and like in costume on Viviende, which can you imagine being like, oh yeah, me and my friends are going to paint ourselves blue because of this national patriotic holiday. It's like, okay, go do anything else with your afternoon.
I mean, I don't know. On every July 4th, I paint my whole face with an American flag, very detailed, but I do it with the Vietnamese star. So it has all 51 stars on it.
That's cool. Yeah, you've been an early adopter of Vietnam as the 51st state.
I knew what was happening. I always knew what was going to happen. On the flip side of it, a lot of what I was thinking about during the episode, and I'm sure this is completely an appropriate thing to do, but let's rate Dr. Manhattan's girlfriends, right?
Wow, okay.
Yeah, mostly in terms of physical attractiveness. No, yeah. I'm kidding. No, what I was trying to do was think about Angela compared to Lori Blake and how he related to her compared to Jenny Slater and how he related to her. And certainly we have a lot more information about Lori Blake and a lot more information about Angela than we do about Jenny Slater. But we certainly get to see a little bit of how him being Dr. Manhattan affected the relationship. And there's also, all of them have the same sequence. There's a sequence with Jenny Slater, a sequence with Lori Blake, and a sequence in this episode with Angela Abar, where they're in bed and have a fight, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing across the board. So I think that's a touch point where you can kind of look at how are these relationships comparable? And in my mind, it feels like Lori Blake's pretty clear to me. It feels like Lori Blake he was with because Lori needed him. And he felt like, oh, well, she's wants to date me, so I am going to date her. Yeah. He was never completely 100% into her. He didn't necessarily love her. It was just, well, this is what I am going to do, so I am going to do this.
Right. Jenny it just Slater. Made sense. It was convenient. And also, I think he was like, oh, finally, a younger girlfriend. Like that side of it was felt like part of it as well.
Yeah. Jenny Slater was him holding on to his humanity. And I think, again, it felt like this obligation of, well, I was dating her before. Nothing's really different now other than the fact that I'm big and blue and can control atoms. So why not just continue? That'll be fine.
I'm sure he would be grasping for, mm-hmm. He was like, my whole life has changed because of this, this proton accident, why I should hold on to these bits of the past so I don't lose them. I mean, if you had to put it down into sort of the way a lot of people date is Jenny's sort of the high school girlfriend that he moves on to college by becoming a blue god. And he's like, I don't want to break up. And then it's like, well, it's over, and sort of breaks up in a shitty way. Then Lori, sort of the college girlfriend, is like, oh, we're here. It's convenient. We're together. She lives on my floor. We have a lot of interests.
Yeah, and let's experiment. Sometimes there's three of me. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, classic college situation. the old one-man thruple, as it's known. And then in this episode, Angela feels like a match. Like he feels like he's met someone. By the end of the episode, it's like she's the one person in the world that's like, hey, man, I know you can see through time a little bit, but fuck you. I'm going to do this. Yeah. And it's obviously a tragic choice that she does, but he loves that about her, that despite the fact that he's a god, she's still like, chill, dude. I'm going to make this choice that I want to make. And that's beautiful and amazing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I don't want to undervalue either of the previous relationships, but it just, exactly like you're saying, feels like a relationship between equals. And it's interesting to watch, particularly later in the episode, how Yaya plays Dr. Manhattan, because you could play Dr. Manhattan very monotone. You could play it very even the entire time, but he lets humanity seep into his performance, where you really do get a sense of that cowl below the Dr. Manhattan, where it's mostly in the corner of his mouth as well, where it just, it'll curl up in a little bit of a smile. His eyes won't even really change at all. But you know, that's all you need to know he loves her. And it's wonderful.
Yeah, and like even if it's whether or not it's an actual aspect of the cow personality underneath Dr. Manhattan, you could also explain it that Dr. Manhattan is in love. So he recaptures some of that humanity that he has lost by being this all-powerful being. When you fall in love, like that brings him back to humanity. So he has those little like he smiles a little bit. He's less cold. He's a little bit more of a human, I think, the entire as a character going forward. And that I think that's a great advancement that they made in this series coming out of the comic book.
Yeah, this gets into another question that I was certainly thinking about and discussing a little bit. And maybe this is jumping too far ahead, but the period. So just to give you guys the broad overview of the episode, just very briefly, we get to see him as Dr. Manhattan. We've seen the period, a lot of the period of where he was Cal Abar, not aware he was Dr. Manhattan. And we get to see the end of the episode where he is Dr. Manhattan again. I am trying to grasp my head around, does he have the memories of the 10 years where he was Cal, or does he not have those because of the device that's put in his head?
I think he does. I think what happened, because the device was designed to make him just forget that he has powers. That's why he knows everything else about Cal as Cal. He just assumes whatever is Angela's telling him is true about his life. You had amnesia. You were in an accident. We're together. We live in Tulsa. Like all those things that Angela fills him in on his life are, he's like, you just had an accident and you lost your memories. So he is Dr. Manhattan the whole time. Then he lives as Cal. And when the device comes out, he's struggling to sort of reconcile it. But my take was that he has all those memories. And that's why he knows he loves her, because he's experienced their whole relationship as well, forward and backward.
Yeah, that was sort of my take as well. I think you touched on this a little bit, but when he finally comes out of it, I get the sense that all of those Cal memories are still jumbled up in there and he hasn't been able to sort through them, which is why when they're having the conversations back in Vietnam, he's not 100% sure about those 10 years, because they essentially have like 5, maybe 10 minutes after he becomes Dr. Manhattan before shit really goes down. And that's probably not enough time for him to be like, great, now I have 10 years of Cal memories and Dr. Manhattan memories. So he's able to understand what's going on while not necessarily comprehend that period of time, because it is blocked by this tachyon emitter or whatever it's called.
Yeah, that's the way I took it. I'm sure some people will have the opposite take, but I think it's a more satisfying episode if that time wasn't just erased. To me, then it's like, oh, what was it for? Like, you want him to, he's not dead yet, obviously, despite what he said, he's just been teleported by the bad guys, the 7th Cavalry. But it would be very unsatisfying to me if he just comes out of that and he's like, hey, I'm Dr. Manhattan again. Oh, should I kill these people? And then I get killed. Like, that to me is like not what it's about. It's about this love and this relationship.
Exactly. All right. But I mean, that was a little bit of a side trip, but let's get back to it.
Yeah, let's get back, because there's so much plot that happens in this episode.
Yes.
So he's in costume. He's wearing a mask. I thought that was very cool just throughout the whole scenes with Angela in Vietnam. He talks about how it's not him on Mars. It's a recording, a decoy. He's actually on Europa, explains his powers. We get to see him creating life and explains all of the weird shit we've seen, the Ozymandias stuff, which was cool to see that just laid out. Directly for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, explaining, so we get to see him create this dome on Europa. We see it close, which gives it a very clear structure. We see him pull Phillips and Crookshank out of the water, create them as the first people. They're shocked. I really like the shot, actually. I like the sparse use of nudity in this episode. I think everybody was kind of expecting a lot of hanging dong from Dr. Manhattan, but the way they used it instead, mostly back nudity, was nice and made sense. And the one shot was pretty great where you actually did get to see it, just the way that it happened, the way that it was framed.
With Ozymandias, I thought that was great. It made it like a great little sort of joke almost, but like, and it showed Dr. Manhattan's sort of innocence where he's like, oh, right, this is weird for you. I don't care, but yeah. I'm naked.
The reason I bring it up here, though, I thought there was this really nice shot of the just-born first Phillips and first Crookshank walking with Dr. Manhattan, and the three of them, and they're all nude from behind, but they're all walking with the same gait across the field, and it gave them this sense of evenness throughout that. I just thought it was really well directed. And I believe this one was directed by Nicole Yassell, who directed the first two episodes. So it was really good to see her back for this one because she's awesome.
Especially this episode spans so much of the different aspects of the show. Like we get this backstory where we learn that as a kid, when they were hiding from the Nazis, he stayed in this manor, and that's the manor that he actually teleports to Europa. Mm-hmm. Where he sees these people having sex, they become his Adam and Eve.
I want to stop here for a moment. So this is the lord and lady of this manor. He explains to Angela that as opposed to everything else on Europa that he created, he actually lifted this manor out of England, right?
Yeah.
And stuck it on Europa. So he actually took it there because... this is very fascinating phrase to hear Dr. Manhattan say, I feel safe there, is what he says. You wouldn't expect that Dr. Manhattan wouldn't feel safe anywhere. But I think that does, again, point to the fact that he is fallible. He does feel emotion. He says he doesn't feel emotion, but he actually does. And I think that's what they really get right in this episode.
And also, it was sort of like, he's going to Europa to create life in the same way that, like, we as humans, we nest a little bit before we, like, have children, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what he's doing. Like, he's bringing the things that when he was a kid made him feel safe, made him, like, in this period where he was, like, literally running from the Nazis with his father. And so he's like, oh, I want this around as I work on this great experiment of my life. And I thought that was sweet. It made him – if the theme of this episode is Dr. Manhattan's humanity returning, this was another great subtle example of that.
Now, two things that I'll mention. One, I was surprised that Phillips and Crookshanks were characters that we've never met before. There's been so much speculation that they were perhaps – John Osterman and Jenny Slater or two other characters we've known previously or something like that. But the fact that we'd never met them before, I thought was kind of fascinating. The other thing, and this is definitely my Jewish sprung out when I saw this, but it was weird and I didn't know what to take away from it, that they're Jewish in 1936 fleeing the Nazis, but they kind of casually mention that, and then they hand him a Bible and they're like, Adam and Eve, isn't that cool? Look at this Christian Bible. And they're very cool about it. Like, they're very like, whatever you want to believe, that's all good. Just read this great book and enjoy this great book. But the fact that this show has been so careful with so many African-American issues, so many Vietnamese issues and other things, that the two times they've dealt with Jewish things in the show, this and the Schindler's List thing, they're like, this is kind of tossed off information. It's fine. I know this is where my brain is focused, but again, it jumped out at me. It's like, I'd like a little bit more. That would be nice. Can we stay on this for a second?
Well, I think this is a weird moment. I think the show is not interested in religion for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And maybe because they're dealing with Dr. Manhattan as a god, they don't want to get into that whole side of the debate or like that as a topic to deal with on this show because they're focusing so much on the other things that you mentioned. Because I think they use the fact that they're Jewish as the story point to get them on the run in England and the Bible as a story point to get them to Adam and Eve. But to your point, I think it is odd that it's like he's Jewish, but then he gloms so hard on this Christian story. But not in a way that it's like, I believe this now. He's just like, I'll make an Adam and Eve.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the main thing. And again, I don't dislike the show because of that or anything like that. It just, perhaps the idea is it would complicate things too much if then you're like, on top of all of the inherited trauma and racial issues that we're dealing with, also, let's talk about Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
You know, it just, it adds an extra layer of complexity to it that maybe isn't necessary and convolutes things too much. But if there is a second season, perhaps there is something they could delve into a little bit more.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that leaves religion as a topic, mm-hmm. especially if Dr. Manhattan does die in the next episode. A dead god is something to talk about in a second season about focusing on religion. Yeah. Now, was go ahead.
Oh, all I was going to say is another note is young John Osterman is running through the halls of this manor. He says that they were like a maze, and that he hides in a cabinet and sees the Lord and Lady of the Manor having sex. It reminded me a lot of Looking Glass's origin, and I don't think it's necessarily pointing to anything so much as another one of these visual parallels that they have going on. Him going through the Hall of Mirrors, going through the maze there, that being his first sexual experience, this being young John's first experience with sex. Again, I think it comes down to that rhyming, like you were saying.
Yeah. Now, was that piece of art in the Bible, was that Dave Gibbons?
It must have been, right?
I thought so, because especially if they're like saying, look, here's a creation myth. And then, of course, you have Dave Gibbons, the creator, one of the creators of Watchmen, draw that. I thought that was nice. So it was only on screen for a split second. I'm just going to – I think we can assume it was that.
Right. I certainly hope so. I mean, it was very clearly not Bible art of the time.
No. It was comic book. It was comic book art. Also, it was like a Bible with one illustration total, it felt like, which is also weird.
Yeah. But yeah, the great scene, interesting origin. Go ahead.
Moving on. So I want to talk a second about the music in this episode. There's so much backing music and bed music, and we get this, the Tunnel of Love as the song that, it's your favorite song. And I thought this was just a good joke. It's your favorite song. And she's like, I've never heard this before. And that's, well, it's not your song yet. Now that you've met me, it will be because of this moment we're living in right now. That was a cool thing. But the scene that I'm talking about where we are right now is a song from a Black Mirror episode.
Hmm.
From the episode where it's the singing competition, and it's in a future where everyone is earning, you earn points, and the guy gives points to the girl so she can go sing, and she sings this song. And I thought that it made me think, and maybe this is just me, but that this episode sort of feels like a Black Mirror episode in some ways.
Interesting.
It has like some of that standalone value, standalone story, and it's like, if you didn't see anything else but this episode, and it was like about a man who has the ability to see all of his life at once and how a love story would work in that way, mm-hmm. I think it does sort of stand alone and as a Black Mirror thing, where you have a device you put in your brain where you forget the things you need to forget so that you can be happy.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And it certainly has a pretty dark ending to it, though, like a lot of more recent Black Mirrors, it also ends in a very romantic way, or at least a slightly more positive way, without totally kicking you in the nuts. Maybe more San Junipero than, say, Metalhead or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. But I thought that was a nice, I don't know if that was the intention of using that song, but it had that effect on me. So they continue talking. It's a nice twisty conversation. And then we get the flashback to the morgue where they're pulling bodies out. She pulls three bodies and then pulls a fourth that is Cal Jelani, who he becomes. And that made me think, this scene was the weirdest one of the episode, I thought.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, all I was going to say is it felt like this was another one where we were missing information, that there was information we didn't weren't given, because Angela shows the three bodies and says, here, these are three people. They have no family. Nobody's going to miss them. Nobody's going to know that if you take over their body, there's going to be no problems. And Dr. Manhattan says, you know, if there's another body you're more comfortable with, we could go with that one. She's like, thinks for a second and says, well, I guess there's this one. I guess I'd be comfortable with this one. And it seems like there's something more there, right?
Yeah. It was odd. And it made me think is like, why did you wait on this other body? Like, and is it right. about that you were attracted to this corpse or like, it was just, the whole thing was a little weird. Was it a race thing? Was it a, like, the whole thing was like, it was confusing. And then it was left unexplained why it was told in that way.
Right.
So I thought it was odd, but fine.
I mean, the thing that I took away from it, and I don't know. I mean, we can certainly talk towards the end of this episode because I have no clue how they're going to wrap up everything in one single hour to conclude this series at this point, because there's an insane amount of things that need to happen. But it felt to me like Angela knew this guy. She knew Calvin Yelani, or however you pronounce his name, because when Dr. Manhattan ultimately takes on his face, the way she looks at him and touches his face, it doesn't feel like she's touching Dr. Manhattan. It feels like she's seeing this guy alive again to me, you know? So I don't know.
It would be crazy if they spend some time in the next hour being like, actually, she went on a date with Cal Yelani once. And it's like, why? We've moved past that. So I don't know. Like, it definitely felt like we are missing information here. And maybe it's something that they were just like, oh, we don't have space in the episode. We'll have to cut out why this happened. And it just leaves a little hanging question there.
Yeah, but it's definitely the way Regina King is playing it is very different from how she's playing everything else. I'll also mention, just on that note, I loved how she gives different notes to a younger Angela than the one we've seen. It feels consistent with the character that we've seen so far, 10 years down the road. But she's clearly younger. She's a little sassier. She's much happier across the board.
Yeah.
And what's clearly been happening is she has spent 10 years loving Calvin, having a good life, getting these three kids, but knowing that she's closer and closer to the point of tragedy, as he tells her is going to happen. And that's just hyping up everything in her performance. So I love that through line. It just felt very consistent to me.
Yeah, I agree. Her performance was great in this episode. And you see, as you jump through time, you can distinctly see the different way she's playing the different Angelas. And that's just so good. So smart.
Yeah.
So we get the fight, the sex scene into the fight that we talked about earlier. They fight, he vanishes, and shows what
there's a thing that happens during the fight. So this is, he tells her that we're going to have a fight. And it's exactly, as we mentioned earlier, it's exactly the same thing that happens with Lori Blake. It's exactly the same thing that happens with, oh my gosh, why am I blanking her name?
Jenny Slater.
Jenny Slater, thank you. Where he tells them they're going to have a fight, and that essentially seems to be the thing that causes the fight, because they're like, I don't want to have a fight with you. And he's like, we're going to have a fight. I don't want to have a fight with you. We're going to have a fight. And they're like, fine, we're fighting now. But the way that this is played again, I thought was great, where Angela is angry, but knows she just needs to give this to him because this is how his existence is. So it's partially a fight and partially her walking through him because they're on this even plane. But there's an interesting moment to the middle, which I might be reading too much into it. Although I don't think there's any point where you could do too much reading into with the show. But he's telling her about his timeline. He's like, well, and I'm at Gillett Flats right now where my watch has been put in the inductive field generator. She's like, oh, so you're dying. I didn't write down what she wrote, but he says, so that's how she says something about that's happening right now. And he says, no, Angela. He doesn't answer her. He says, no, Angela, I'm being torn apart right now. And I think what he's actually referring to is what happens at the end of the episode, not the event in Gila Flats.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Which I think is a little bit of foreshadowing there.
Yeah. Oh, God. Stressful.
Yes.
This episode, if I can make a larger observation real quick, this episode is one of those pieces of like entertainment that is great, but also inherently frustrating because you see characters that you like making choices that result in bad things happening for them.
Yeah.
And there's a stress associated with watching like shows and movies that have this that drives me crazy. And this definitely had it. The biggest example of that, another thing that has that, is the end of Dumb and Dumber. Okay. We may be the only podcast that makes this connection.
I don't think so. I think they're going to do it on the official one, too.
Yeah. But at the end of Dumb and Dumber, when the bus pulls up with all the models and they don't get on, there's a frustration to that where I'm just like, oh, God, I just want them to not blow it. And I felt that same feeling in this episode where it was like, oh, just make better choices, and it doesn't happen.
Well, I think that gets back to the central idea of the episode, right? Where he tells her, we're going to have 10 years together, we're going to have kids, and then we're going to experience tragedy. And she asks him, she says, why would we ever do that? Why would I do that if there's going to be tragedy? And he says two things to her. One, he says, haven't you done anything you've ever regretted? And then he also says that, by definition, don't all relationships end in tragedy?
Great.
Which is like a fucking deep line that normally I don't write down lines that hard during an episode, but that was a line where I was like, I feel like I got to get that tattooed on my arm or something, because
I hope you do. Now, can you relate that to Dumb and Dumber at all? Or no?
It's by definitions, don't all relationships end in tragedy is like when he's pooping in the toilet.
Yes.
When it's just going and going and going. And it ends eventually.
Yes, in tragedy.
But it's tragic.
That line was so just what a well-written line. Such a smart observation.
The reason I bring that up now is to your point, and I think that gets to the romantic crux of the episode, is the risk worth the punishment instead of is the risk worth the reward? And that's the same thing Adrian Veidt is dealing with, which we'll be talking about in a second. But ultimately, the decision that they make is these 10 years being in love and being together are worth whatever happens next, whatever heartbreak happens next. And that's what all great romance is about, is them choosing each other instead of whatever's going to happen to them.
Yeah. And but before we get to that, it's stressful. Yes. Before we get to all that, we get this scene with Dr. Manhattan, now Cal, at Ozymandias's Antarctic base in Antarctica, which is sort of fallen apart a little bit. And I thought this whole sequence was sort of the sequel, the Watchmen sequel, the most sequel-y of anything we've seen in the show so far. And I thought this was great. It really hit that sort of thirst of like, oh, this is what happened after with these specific people and places. And I thought it was great.
Well, the way that they perfectly recreated Karnak off of Dave Gibbons' drawings in this episode, I mean, I know most of it was probably CGI modeling or whatever, but it looked perfect, like absolutely perfect. It was worse for the wear, which I thought was a pretty clear reference to the whole Ozymandias poem, the look on my work, she mighty in despair. But the statue of Ozymandias is broken down and crumbling, which is exactly what's happening here. He's still sitting in front of his bank of TVs, except his remote isn't working. The TVs aren't working.
Great.
And I love the detail of just the way that he's making the squid rain, that he's basically doing it manually still.
Yeah.
And he's just
so
plugging
funny.
These quarter inch cords into things. And the squids are just like blurping out of this pipe is great.
Yeah, and it's sort of like time to make the donuts. Like, oh, fuck, I got to make it rain squid in Chicago for the next hour.
Yeah.
Now, like, it's so funny.
I do wonder, since he has been gone for 8 years, how are the squids still raining, if that's so? I mean, I don't know. Again, I don't want to be like, don't worry about it too much. I assume it's Lady True. He left some sort of, in the case of my disappearance, take care of this type thing, probably.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. There's actually a lot in this scene worth talking about, I think. There's this line that's right after the squid stuff, is a little elephant told me. In reference to Dr. Manhattan talking about Will Reeves and all that. And what is that about? That's Lady True.
Right.
Clearly. Does that maybe point to the fact that she somehow has Dr. Manhattan-like powers, in that she at that time would know about the entire story? Or what?
Potentially. I think more it just points to, we know from a bunch of the back matter that they were business partners. I don't remember the exact timeline, but I believe she bought him out after he disappeared, but she had already bought a large chunk of his company because his company had failed.
Yes.
After the squid explosion, he had lost a ton of money, a ton of support, and she came in and I believe bought a controlling interest in the company or large chunks of it or something like that. So they certainly know each other, but it sounds like kind of what we've suspected for a while, that they've been working together beyond that. So potentially whatever Lady True's plan is may also be Adrian Veidt's plan.
Yes, but how would Lady True be connected to Will Reeves at this point?
I don't know. Unless
I heard it incorrectly, that is what I thought they were referencing, is because Dr. Manhattan's talking about how he has to go do a couple other things.
Is it Will Reeves? I think it was before that. I don't think it's a reference to Will Reeves. I think it's him being on Earth or not being on Mars or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. I can't tell in my notes because right after that they talk about how he knows he's in love. I thought they were talking about Angela Abar and what her origin is. There's something about a little elephant told me was felt like a pin was put in that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of what we're going to find out in this final episode is what is the connection between Lady True and Adrian Veidt? Is he her father, like a lot of people have suspected? Do they have some other connection? Is he in the gold statue? All of these things we've been talking about. I think we're going to get definitive answers on them next episode. There's another exchange that happens right before that, though, where Veidt calls him out on having Cal's face, where he says, it's not the 80s anymore. You can't just do this thing, which I thought was, A, so funny, but B, kind of weird that they sort of brushed past it and used that as their excuse for it.
Especially using the word problematic specifically and then being like, hey, it's problematic. And then sort of a joke about the 80s, I thought was, it was almost being like, go ahead. This is where if you want to come for us, here's the scene.
Yeah. It is interesting, though, because given the way the show has been so far, I feel like there's a lot that could be done, and maybe it will be done more next episode, though I sort of doubt it, on the fact that the most powerful man in the world has changed from a white man, a white Jewish man, to a black man and appropriated that face. I think the thing that you potentially could say in its defense is Angela is giving him permission and it is Angela's idea. So it's not like he's putting on blackface. It's he is becoming this other person, which is a very different sort of thing.
And, you know, maybe that explains her hesitancy in the scene we were questioning before of opening that. She opens because are the first three people she pulls out, are they all white dudes?
I think there's a white dude, probably a Vietnamese dude. He was certainly Asian and maybe another white dude. Yeah.
It's interesting because maybe that's she was like, well, I'm not going to say he should become this black man because that would be weird. But then he sort of pushes her into that choice. Maybe that could explain it. But it's still to your point, there is a lot that they could unpack there. And I would think the show has put such a focus on unpacking race, trauma, and things associated with that, that they might want to do that.
Right. I think so, too. I mean, that said, this was, I believe, the longest episode so far. So it's possible they just might not have had the time to deal with that in between everything else they needed to deal with and make this an effective love story, which is what they did.
Yeah. Running forward, I think there's just a great scene where Ozymandias is like, oh, you're in love again, you idiot. I thought that was just played really nicely. The doubling line of your profound lack of imagination, you must have a wild imagination. That was a sweet sort of almost middle point of the episode where the two strings meet and then keep go off in the either direction. I thought that was cool. I thought we got our new version of I did it 35 minutes ago was mm-hmm. I made it 30 years ago, which I yes. thought was so subtly done and great to hear.
It was great. And he reveals that back in the day in the, I want to say it's final issue of Watchmen, when Dr. Manhattan shows up, he traps him in a tachyon generator and makes him explode, though Dr. Manhattan immediately reforms himself and comes back into Karnak, bursting a big hole in the wall with his giant body. What Veidt reveals is that was actually his plan B. His plan A was to get him to use this tachyon emitter, the smaller one, put it in his head and erase his memory. I don't know how he was going to get him to do that necessarily. Yeah,
that's probably why it didn't work. It was like, well, right. I made the device, but how do I get it in his brain? And now he uses love to do it.
Yeah. And he does get it. He gives it to him. Dr. Manhattan explains that he has other things, other jobs to do. But we also get a very clear underlining of Veidt's character, which Veidt reveals. He says, I did this whole thing. I saved the world. But other than myself and a couple of people, nobody knows and nobody's thanked me. And yeah. So Dr. Manhattan explains, well, I created this world on Europa with these people who love me. They're just looking for somebody to adore. I find it boring. Maybe you'd like that. And Veidt starts crying and says, yes, that would be nice. And he sends him there. Now, two thoughts off of this. Well, actually, one main thought I think it boils down to. Is Veidt being truthful here? Or is this all part of his plan as well?
To me, I thought it was a moment of weakness where he's just so tired. He's tired of fighting he's stressed out by watching the world. Nothing's changed. He stopped this one thing, but everyone's still miserable. All of his business has failed. Like, I think he is like truly exhausted. And so I believe him in that moment that he does want to go to this utopia.
So then to that point, we know based on the candles at the end of the episode that he's been there for 7 years at this point. When did he start to hate it, do you think?
He started to hate it pretty like year one. When we see him at the beginning of the season in episode one, he's frustrated. But he also does say, I mean, this is something for later perhaps with a horseshoe. He's like, don't give that to me yet. So he does seem like he's aware of the timeline.
Right. That is the main thing, that horseshoe, that makes me wonder how much of this was purposeful out of his part. Because if a year in, he already had this plan that was going to pay off in year seven, when did he come up with that? And potentially you could say, okay, he's Adrian Veidt. He's the smartest man in the world. He could come up with that in a week and lay down that plan and that would be fine. And certainly there's a lot of time where we don't see what's going on there. But it almost feels to me like part of his plan was, I need to be taken off the board for 7 to 8 years in order for whatever it is to work.
But what is he, I mean, he's getting old. What's he in? What's his plan for at this point? To get back on top?
Get younger. I mean, we've talked about how Lady True created a younger version of her mother. Maybe she created a younger version of Adrian Veidt, who may or may not be her father. It also might be to get Dr. Manhattan powers as well. You know, he looks at everybody loves Dr. Manhattan and talks about Dr. Manhattan all the time, but they never talk about Adrian Veidt. So maybe that's what he wants. He wants the adulation. He wants the cheering for the crowds.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I don't know.
Well, I guess we'll talk about that in a second. So they he vanishes. He goes to Europa. We'll see more of him later. Back with Angela and Cal, they decide to start over. They go to Tulsa.
Mention, so they have this really beautiful scene where she puts the device in his head. And as they're talking, and telling they love each other, we flash to their shadows on the wall, which are the same shadows from the Hiroshima lovers that we saw repeated throughout the comic book, which I don't think we've seen as imagery on the show yet. But essentially, if you're not familiar with that, that's in the real world when the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There are people that are caught in it, and their ash were left looking like shadows on the wall. That is a theme that was repeated throughout the comic book, where the two lovers holding on to each other in this ash were left behind. And that clearly points to exactly what they've been talking about the entire time, that Cal and Angela are doomed, that their shadows are left behind. The ashes of them are going to be left behind, just like these lovers in Hiroshima.
Yeah, spot on. And then we get this exchange of, can you give someone your powers? Mm-hmm. Put the powers into an organic object and they can transfer them. This is clearly what's going to play into the next episode.
Yeah, this. So there's two potential ways this could go. One, it could be, we know the 7th Cavalry's plan is to turn themselves into Dr. Manhattan's. We now know it is how it is possible to get Dr. Manhattan's powers, that he can transfer it through organic material like food. He would never do it without somebody's permission, but potentially they could trick him into do it or force him into do it in some way, potentially, so that they could, or maybe they just straight up eat him. It's a bunch of cannibals eating Dr. Manhattan. I don't know. But the other thing that happens, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but he walks across the pool and says, it's important that you saw me do that for later. So it seems to me that potentially, also considering that, like, as Cal, he's been feeding them eggs, and we've seen scenes of him cooking, and he's even making waffles in this episode, that he potentially is, in fact, feeding something to Angela, or feeding something to the kids, or all of them, that is going to give their powers to them.
Yeah, my first thought was Topher. Because of the sort of he's had a similar spotlight shined on him that Cal had, where it's like, why are we paying attention to these characters when they don't seem at all connected to the rest of the story besides being Angela's family? So I think you're right. That to me was the one thing which he and Dr. Manhattan at that point puts the kids somewhere safe and maybe is juicing them up with some,
Topher was the one that I thought of as well, particularly it's a little tricky to think about because we do find out that he, once the device is in his head, he won't use his powers except for unconsciously, essentially as a reflex. So to say that he cooked a bunch of eggs for Topher and gave him Dr. Manhattan powers at some point seems a little ridiculous because it wouldn't necessarily be a reflex unless that's something that he set for himself as a trigger, as a reflex, before he ever had the device in there. But I do think you're right. It definitely seems like something's going on with Topher and something's going to happen with Topher. And it certainly seems like something with Dr. Manhattan, given that we've seen blue light in his bedroom before. We've seen him washing away the building that he made with the magna tiles the same way that Dr. Manhattan washed away the matter in the footage on Mars. But yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So then we flash forward to where we ended last episode. We see now Dr. Manhattan, now Cal Hatton, in the blue. He's glowing.
Ooh, I like it. You should trademark that.
Yeah, Cal Hatton. great little neighborhood on the Upper East Side. He seems a little off. He's disoriented, which is, this is when he's at his most vulnerable, both in the comics and in the series. He can't really tell when he is. We get the revelation of what happened on the White Knight, where he zaps the guy away. And we learn that Angela's pissed at him, like, where are the kids? And we he sent the kids to Will, who is at the theater downtown.
You're skipping over a very important point, which is a couple of episodes ago, I said it looked like Topher had a stuffed Bubastis, and you guys made fun of me. That is definitely a stuffed Bubastis toy that he has, that he's holding.
And we only made fun of you just because you focus on the stuffed animals so much in the middle of this great television show. But agreed. You got your revenge.
This show is 90% about stuffies and like 10% about inherited trauma.
Yeah, that's true. No one would argue with that. So then the revelation of the kids are being with Will takes us to Dr. Manhattan meeting up with Will. We learn that Will took the inheritance from Captain Metropolis.
Nelson Gardner, and, yeah.
And we get he wants to team up with Hood of Justice, and then we start to get the sort of mistakes here. The conversation across time where ask him how he knew about Judd. And
How did he know about Judd Crawford? How did he know about Cyclops? How did he know about the Ku Klux Klan robe in his closet? And Dr. Manhattan asks him, and he says, who's Judd Crawford? He brings it back to Agile, and Agile's like, oh, shit, did I cause this? Is this my fault?
Yeah.
Now, I'm of the mind that she didn't, that this kind of, like a lot of the stuff with Dr. Manhattan, is inevitable. So it's not, it's a time loop. It is a paradox that she caused, as he talked about, but it's not her fault. It's just part and parcel of how time works in this universe.
I agree with you. And Dr. Manhattan says as much, like, you can't stop this from happening with all of the events that sort of transpire. But I do think Angela caused it. She, that moment, that conversation across time was the trigger point that caused both all the Judd stuff. And then a scene and a half later, she causes the death of Cal Haddon.
Though the other side of the argument is things, and we'll see how they turn out in the next episode, but things potentially could be a lot worse.
I'm not saying she did the wrong thing. I'm just saying she was the catalyst for all this stuff. And I think, right. I mean, well, I don't think the show's going to end with Calvary, like, well, Angela, I don't think the show's going to end with it being like, well, Angela, you fucked up big time, and her being sad. I think we're going to find a resolution here. She's a hero. It's just, and she's just trying to sort through this insane life that she has.
Right.
And at the end of the day, Dr. Manhattan is the thing that causes all of it because of his ability to mess with the structure of time and events. But she is definitely she pushed over the domino.
Yeah. If anything, the part that is her fault potentially is deciding to move with Dr. Manhattan to Tulsa, not, I think, saying this thing, because the Seventh Cavalry would have still existed if Judd Crawford hadn't died. Nobody would have known about their plans. None of this would have happened. Potentially Lady True would have stopped it, but Dr. Manhattan needs to be there for the Seventh Cavalry's plans to go from taking over the presidency to taking over the world, right?
Right, yeah.
So that, if anything, is a mistake, I think, not causing the paradox. Though, yes, to your point, yeah, that is her fault as well.
But and
everything's
just
her fault.
Everything's her fault. And to button up, we get the moment where he fell in love with her, is her fighting against him and going outside. And then she shoots a bunch of people and then gets caught. He goes outside to save her because she wouldn't listen to what he was. She was bucking his prediction. And then because he goes out to save her, he gets zapped by the forced teleportation. So one of those things where you're just trying to grasp, be like, wait, oh, just don't. And then it happens and it's heartbreaking.
Several things about this that I love that I noted down. First of all, I don't know if we've heard it before. I don't think this was Cal and Angela's theme, but it's definitely introduced in this episode, and the music has been phenomenal across the board. It seems to me that they introduced Dr. Manhattan and Angela's love theme in this episode, which is what's playing under that action scene as she tries to save him and then he tries to save her. It's absolutely a gorgeous piece of music, but because they bring up the music over the action and you can't really hear the gunplay or the fighting or anything like that, it almost seemed to be like it was a romantically motivated action scene, which is something that I don't think I've necessarily seen before.
Yeah.
Like it's the way Angela is telling Dr. Manhattan she loves him is by going out and killing these dudes. And he's doing the same thing. And it is uber violent, but that's how it plays. It plays like two people who love each other. And that's beautiful.
It is, and like Dr. Manhattan doesn't need to go out there, and he doesn't need to like physically blow each of them away individually with his hand. Like he could just snap his fingers and they'd all go away. But he goes out there and he performatively fights them and kills them to protect her. And I thought that was a love move. That was like being a hero as opposed to just like getting it done. And that's what ends up with causing him to be shot.
Yeah. So I think pretty clearly based on what he said at this point, haven't killed him. They've teleported him away, probably put him in that cage where Laurie Blake is currently tied in front, is going to see him appear there. That's going to be
a whole thing. What a great setup for them to have like a fucked up conversation.
Yeah. That's going
to
be
like, I just fell in love with a woman you don't like.
And then we flash back to Vietnam and they have their last conversation, which is their first conversation, where he says, by definition, don't all relationships end in tragedy. He ends up asking her out on a date, asking her out to dinner, and she says yes. And that's where the episode ends, except for the end credits tag, the first time that we get an end credit scene, which is Adrian Veidt getting pummeled in the face by those apple tomatoes that he was growing. At one after the other, the Phillips and Crookshanks are coming up to him, shoving them in his face and saying, are you still going to leave? And he says, yes. Are you still going to leave, Master? Yes. And it's so clear now that we've been told it, that the entire time they're doing this because they love him and they want him to stay.
This is so good. Yeah, it was. They were like, will you stay, Master? He's like, no. And then just splat. Like, it's so, like, worshippers encountering their god and being sad, or like children and their father just like mushing tomato in his face. It was super, super fun. We get him in the cell with a honey cake. We already talked about this a little bit. Pulls out the horseshoe. We learn that, we learn that the warden is the original Adam clone, which I thought was interesting. Great line, heaven doesn't need me. He needs to leave. And he finds the horseshoe in the cake, which he uses to open a hatch. The hatch from Lost, as I've said, all comes back to that.
It all ties together. Two details that I'll mention about this. One, he's reading Fog Dancing again, which is the book that we've seen pop up a bunch of times in a bunch of different hands that is written by the guy who wrote the story of the squid, essentially, for Adrian Veidt and then disappeared. It's interesting to me that Adrian Veidt, in this case, says, no, I rather like this book. We don't know what the plot of Fog Dancing is, but it certainly seems to point to something in terms of what he's doing, I would think.
Yeah. I don't know what that is, but yes.
Yeah. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention based on what you were saying is I think that it is the God thing and them rejecting, not rejecting God, but being very sad that God is leaving them. But also it gets back to, by definition, don't all relationships end in tragedy, because they love him and he wants to leave them. And that for them is their tragedy. And for Adrian Veidt, it's the same thing, where he thought he was coming to a place where he'd be loved and adored. And it turned out to not be what he wants after all.
Yes. No
so
fun.
Just overall, awesome episode. Great episode. Do you have, before we wrap up here, any big theories or things you want to see in the finale?
Well, like we've talked about, like, I don't know what they're going to do to wrap this up. All the characters are in, I think we have Dr. Manhattan, Laurie, and Looking Glass all at the abandoned mall with the 7th Cavalry. I think we're going to see Will. We have Will and the kids are in downtown Tulsa. I think they're going to play into it. Angela, obviously she's going to, she doesn't know where the 7th Cavalry is.
So no, I don't know how she's going.
She's going to have to figure out how to do that. I think Dr. Manhattan is going to die. I've already mentioned that before, I think. I think we're going to get a great scene between Laurie and Dr. Manhattan, and it's going to be an argument, potentially. I think Lady True's plan, we've speculated a little bit, a couple things of them, like maybe giving everyone powers, I think was your theory. I think I had said erasing everyone's memory as a potential way of evening the playing field. And I think this episode dealing with memory so much with Dr. Manhattan maybe speaks to that a little bit. I don't know. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of that. The thing that I'm most curious about is whatever is going on with Lady True and the Millennium Clock. That certainly seems to be pointing to what the squid of it at all is going to be for the finale. Yeah. And the other thing that I'm curious about is how much, to use your word again, rhyming there's going to be with the first episode, whether we're going to go back to that street in Tulsa. And I'm sure they do this responsibly. It feels horrific to even think about. But are we going to see something like a modern day Tulsa massacre going on, since we saw that in the first episode? On our bonus podcast, we talked about this a little bit with our guest, Josh Wigler. Are we going to see a movie playing to end it? Are we going to see Sister Night, the Nun with the Motherfucking Gun, or something else, or end with the Bass Reeves film in some way? In a weird way, I'm very interested in the entire episode, but I'm most curious with what image they're going to end it with, because to me, that's going to point to the longevity of this show. That really is going to be whatever that final image is, that final thought is going to be what it leaves people with. And the beginning, those first 5 to 10 minutes were so strong and so powerful. Will they be able to match that in the same way? That's what I'm curious to see.
Yeah. And obviously, I think Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels will arrive finally to
on that Swedish supermodel bus.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Main thing you should take away from this podcast: go watch Dumb and Dumber. Great
movie. Yeah, that's the smartest way we can make a connection to this great show, The Watchmen, is by bringing up Dumb and Dumber.
All right, a couple of things before we go. We do a bonus podcast that is only in the Watchmen Watch feed, usually with special guests, where we talk about theories and your comments and ideas, talk about the promo for the final episode and other things. So if you got any thoughts you want to share with us that you'd like us to talk about on the podcast, hit us up, particularly on Twitter, at WatchmenWatch1. We'd love to hear from you there. Also, we have a Patreon Slack, patreon.com/comicbookclub. You can join it for as low as $2 a month and chat about all of our shows, but there's been very healthy discussion about Watchmen, so we would love to get your thoughts and feedback there as well. Other social networks you can check us out on: Facebook and Instagram, Watchmen Watch Podcast. We do a live show every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. at the People's Improv Theater Loft in New York. Come on by there and we will chat with you about Watchmen. Comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and more. You can subscribe and comment on iTunes, Android, Spotify, and Stitcher, or the app of your choice. And remember, we taped this podcast 30 years ago.